Redacted Media presents, in association with Ghost Hat Media, the Filmological Society Essentials, a podcast conversation on the films that made cinema. And now, here are your commentators, Chris Scholz and T.C. DeWitt.
And welcome, and you just heard the fanciest introduction ever for the new series that we're launching on the Filmological Society, The Essentials.
Essentials. But it's a lot of pressure for me to now go back and record a very fancy opening.
I know. Well, I don't know about you, but for The Essentials. So just to sum up before we talk about, you know, how we're dressed and mm-hmm. what type of tea we're drinking. Mm-hmm. The Essentials, it's the films that all the other films are based on, all the references, everything that goes back to these films. These are the ones that everyone has heard of or everyone knows about. But mm-hmm. you know what? They're from a long time ago, and maybe I haven't seen them.
These are the definitive films. This isn't to be confused with movies that it's shocking that people haven't seen with the you haven't seen what Filmological, where it's... It's, what do you mean you haven't seen a Star Wars movie? What?
Okay, right.
These are the essentials of cinema. These are the films, as Scholz, as you just said, that defined American cinema.
Yep. And if you are a film student or really want, these are the films that the directors that you love that are out today, these are the films that they loved. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking the big ones, the Citizen Kanes, the Seven Samurai.
And today. All the,
was that?
And today's.
And today, Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, Mr. James Dean. Jimmy yep. Dean, not the sausage so, guy, the actor guy.
So I am one of your hosts. I am Chris Scholz. I am joined with the other host for Essentials, T.C. DeWitt. Hello, T.C.
Hello. This three-piece suit is very restricting of my breathing,
but the loosen the cummerbund.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch needs to be loosened. Here we go.
Right, right. I am in my tux, mm-hmm. my Oscar tux. So, I'm in Calvin Klein. I see that you are in Gander Mountain. That is yes. a nice choice for
Thank
a
you.
Suit.
Thank you. They don't. So, yeah. There's not a lot of tuxedos made completely out of denim and flannel, but I found one.
Mm-hmm. With built-in waders. That is yes. nice. That is nice. Yeah, so as we talked about, so this, today's review is Rebel Without a Cause from 1955. It is in color, and we'll talk about why that's significant in a little bit. But for both TC and I, this is the first time that we've ever seen this film.
Correct. Yeah. The most I knew about this, I knew James Dean was in it. I know that it is an essential. I know that Fry's outfit from Futurama is designed after the Jim character in here. Mm-hmm. I know the "You're tearing me apart" was from here, which was yep. made much more famous, I think, by Tommy Wiseau in The Room. Just slightly better than this movie. I don't know. We'll discuss it.
We'll discuss. Yeah, maybe I'll change your mind on that.
Yeah, but that's the extent of my knowledge going into this, knowing it's a classic and those couple minor pop cultural touchstones.
So yeah, I mean it, and I knew some of those as well. I think there were a couple other things that I had been aware of. But researching this film, it is a fascinating piece of American cinema. Mm-hmm. Considering James Dean, as famous as he is, and he is one of the big actors, three yeah, films,
yeah, you'd be three hard movies. Three movies. Yeah, that's insane that's because it. he's one of the definitive faces of classic Hollywood, right up there with Marlon Brando and Marilyn Monroe, Humphrey Bogart, like the golden age of cinema And he only made three movies. It's amazing.
Three movies. He died at the age of 24 in a car accident a month before this film came out. So really, in his life, there's only one film that he was at the premiere of.
Jeez. That is absolutely incredible.
And he was nominated for two Oscars. One was for East of Eden, his one film that was released, and that was his first film. And then for this film, he was also nominated for an Oscar. And then the third film he was in was Giant. Mm-hmm.
It's incredible to me to watch this now, knowing the significance of his role in it. And it comes from the 50s, and the 50s were a transitional period of cinema, where having indulged in classic cinema well ahead of when I was born, like traveling back and watching old films, you can see the period of transition between filming theater, which is what a lot of classic film looks like, mm-hmm. and the movement of cameras and the changes in performance and the changes in writing. And there are some really significant moments in this where, understanding that James Dean was method, he's one of the original method actors. There are a few scenes in this movie that are as good as anything you'd watch today.
Yeah.
There is certainly some very theatrical performances, stage theater stylings to this film because mm-hmm. of the era it came in. But the music in particular stands out to me as obnoxious. I love classic cinema. I'm not trying to knock it, but it stands out so significantly because it's very 1950s, 1960s television orchestra of like, and the horns are telling you what's happening. Right.
Yep.
But there are some very well performed scenes in this movie that are as good as stuff you see today.
Yeah, so for me and with the other lists and other films that I've seen, like I was expecting, you know, from the 1950s, a little campiness, a little, you know, very much telling calling cards that this is from the 50s and all that. Mm-hmm. This film, I mean, they talk about timeless films. I think this one falls into it. Like, it feels like the emotions that the characters are going through and how their reactions are, all of that feels like it could be done today.
It does. It feels contemporary. I think the most contemporary feeling performance for me, and thematically the most contemporary, was Pluto, the young boy. Who's actually
Sal Mineo?
Yeah, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, I believe. Correct.
Yep. Yeah,
his performance and struggling with what I don't know if this was intentional. I know of the era it was illegal to talk about homosexuality.
Yeah,
I got the impression that it wasn't just that he was this lonely kid looking for a family, but that there was some struggling with his identity sexually. The way he looked at James Dean, there was some moments where I thought, I think this kid, whether he knows it or not, the character, and maybe this is something the actor brought, whether he knows it or not, he's looking at James Dean in a very attracted way.
Yeah.
Well,
let's there's a couple things that I think are important there. The first is the MPAA was in full power at this time.
Yeah, talking Seduction of Innocent era, Red Scare, anything that looked depraved, they were like, shut it down!
So, yeah, between the Hollywood code, essentially, the studio code, and then also states and cities would have certain levels of tolerance for the type of film that could be shown there. Mm-hmm. And in order to be done by the major studios, it had to go through the Movie Picture Association Alliance or whatever. Mm-hmm. And get a rating. That's how we have our ratings today of PG, PG-13R, because we still are going through that. Mm-hmm. But there was a huge crackdown of what could and couldn't be done. I mean, this is why in the parents' bedroom, there are two beds. The kisses could only last so long. Homosexuality and all that was out. There was no blood at all. You know, the only blood that you saw, I think, was on James Dean's shirt after he took it off. Mm-hmm. Not before, where the blood was coming out, but after he took it off, then there was blood. So all of that, you know, there are some parts that if this were made today, mm-hmm. would be a lot more graphic, would feel a lot more real. So I think that's where you kind of go to the theater level, mm-hmm. where you have to use some theater techniques to do that. But, yeah, the homosexuality. So it was a conscious decision to push the line as close as possible to that. Really? So between James Dean, the director, and Nicholas Ray, and the actor Sal Mineo playing Plato, they wanted to push it. They wanted to you know, James Dean was pushing for a male-to-male kiss in the film.
Wow. Well,
that never would have happened.
I'm glad to hear that I wasn't reading between the lines or like making something up. It read that way to me, and I think that as far as the overall script and story and everything we get here goes, that and especially as you're saying, this feels like it could be made now in a lot of ways. I think that story in particular has a place in contemporary cinema. That feels like the point of inspiration for a lot of indie stuff, a lot of even some of the lesser mainstream stuff, such as, you know, if you want to go to like Moonlight or whatnot. I know I'm there's a huge difference, a vast difference between movies that struggle with this stuff now, but the thematically, performance, the subtlety of it, I think, was ahead of its time. And it makes me happy to hear that James Dean pushed for it, because I can imagine how difficult it would be to work with someone who was so method. I'm sure it was a difficulty, especially for some of the more classic actors in this, like Thurston Howell and Chief from Get Smart.
Yeah, Thurston Howell. It was interesting. Okay, we'll get into that in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, for a film in 1955, and be it, you know, it's Hollywood, whatever. But in 1955, Hollywood was a much different place than it is today.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of diversity in this film would never fly now. It was noticeable just how white this movie is. And
yeah,
as egregious as that was, another thing that I just had to chuckle at were the crow's feet on these so-called 17-year-old kids. My God, they are damn near 30. All of them in this, except Natalie Wood.
Natalie Wood and the actor Sal Mineo were both 16.
But everyone they else looked 16. Like they were 30.
Yep, James Dean was 24. But yeah, I don't know the ages of the rest of them.
Like
Buzz
and his gang. I know Dennis Hopper was in there with like no lines
of
dialogue.
Yeah, a very young Dennis Hopper, yeah.
But they looked so silly. Like especially when Jim goes to school and he's walking up and the guy's like, "Hey, you stepped on the seal." And he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's my first day." Like, are you the principal? Oh, no, I'll see you in chemistry.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting because, again, I think what I liked about Sal Mineo's performance is, you know, you could tell, you're going back to homosexuality, you could tell he was really pushing the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, he didn't know, he didn't fit in, but also, you know, his parents basically have abandoned him.
He's making up lies. I love that he lied about who his father was.
Yep.
And, oh no, my dad's dead. Really? I thought you said he did this. All that little stuff. I know James Dean is the star of this, and we'll surely discuss him more, but I think it's well worth discussing Sal Mineo and just his, right? Am I saying it's Sal Mineo?
Mineo.
Sal Mineo.
Yeah.
And his performance in this is, it, as I said already, it does not shock me that he was nominated for an Oscar, because the craft of his performance.
Well, he was.
Yeah. The craft of his performance and all its subtlety was interesting, matched against James Dean, who had made very deliberate, big choices. And it was hard for me to separate as a viewer, knowing how method he is. and having produced films with you, Scholzi, and produced films, mm-hmm. I don't know if I would be able to handle someone who is so method. Right?
We will talk about that because I have okay. a nice little story. But one final point about how James Dean. So James Dean took Salmoneo aside, and he suggested to him to have Plato look at me the way I look at Natalie.
Oh wow!
So using that direction, so that I mean, again, it's unfortunately, we don't know a lot about James Dean personally because when you die at age 24, you are just learning, you're just becoming a person, you're becoming your own person at that point. And it would have been very obviously interesting to see how who he became,
the trajectory of his career, the fact that Dennis Hopper isn't here, the fact that James Dean's a contemporary of Marlon Brando.
Yes,
those are two different trajectories right there.
Yeah,
hearing you tell me that James Dean was basically pulled him aside and gave him that direction, which I saw out of Sal's performance, you got to wonder. Yeah, is this someone who would have became an auteur director of film, an actor director, someone like Warren Beatty, who just invested his emotions and everything into directing and performing? It is what a loss! Wow. Ugh.
Yeah. And you can see why this film is like iconic. And I mean, I'm. I'm remembering like movies like Clueless. There's the character in there when Alicia Silverstone is trying to find that boyfriend, and she gets the first friend that she dates, not her brother,
mm-hmm.
and and he's emulating James Dean.
Yeah,
but I don't think so much as James Dean. It's the fact that James Dean. His character in this film accepted Sal, accepted Plato,
Plato
for who
Plato.
He was. Mm-hmm. He was Plato's friend, and there were some contemporary reviews of the film that are, pulsing was the character Plato and Salmoneo was that the first actor to be nominated for an Oscar playing an LGBT character.
I'm on board with that. I think that's incredible. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, and sadly, Salmoneo also died early.
Jeez.
So the three main actors in this all died tragic deaths early.
Natalie Wood drowned, right? Was she drowned in a pool or in the ocean or?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And there's some like mystery about whether or not her husband at the time killed her. If I'm remembering my Hollywood urban legends correctly. Jesus.
Yep.
Well, yep. Go ahead.
I was going to say Sal died at the age of 37.
Wow.
In 1976.
I certainly want to talk more about James and his performance as Jim Stark here, but let's talk about Natalie Wood since she was just brought up.
Yes.
She's quite an interesting character. She's manic. Like her character of, is it Julie or Jane? What is it? It's Julie.
Judy.
Judy. What is her deal? Okay. I mean, your dad doesn't want to kiss you anymore. What is happening here? There's some weird stuff happening here.
There's a little weird stuff. I mean, I think it's similar, right? I mean, the internal struggle, you're becoming, you're going from little girl to woman, just the emotions kind of going through, just any child going through that age. I mean, obviously, I don't know from a woman's viewpoint.
You will, my friend, because you have a little one who will
I do have this. I do have one that will, but there is that adjustment, and there are some societal norms as well that, mothers and fathers generally aren't as affectionate with their teenage and 20-year-old children as they are with their, you know, younger little toddler-aged kids.
Yeah, she is a woman. She is a girl who thinks she's a woman. And yes, it's very telling from the beginning when Judy's upset because her dad made her take her lipstick off and she ran away and he called me a floozy, and she's just so dramatic. And I'm not criticizing her for her drama, because it seems very immature and naive and innocent. And she this whole movie takes place in about a 24-hour period.
24-hour period. It does. Yep. 24
and
hours.
She, in a 24-hour period, watches her boyfriend die and then tells a new guy she loves him. She is suffering some trauma, and she's trying to grow up so quickly that it's frustrating in how relatable it is in a lot of ways, being, you know, twice her age at this point and being able to look at that and go, oh, child. But at the same time, similarly, I'm rereading Harry Potter for the sixth time, and I have to, any sort of shaking my head at Harry, I have to go, oh, that's right, he's 14. The decisions he's making are the mind of a child. And much like that to Judy here, it's like Judy is, she's very lost, and she's very confused, and she's trying so hard to just be taken seriously as a woman when she's still just a little girl. It's
right. Well, and part of her just still wants to be that little girl.
Yeah.
And she's not able to. So in the casting, Natalie Wood really, really wanted this role, but the director didn't see her for it. Because, you know, it was like a juvenile delinquent type thing.
Okay.
And she looked young. She was younger than the rest of the cast, you know, with a couple of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So she, she did a couple of things. She like dolled herself. She dressed, she changed her hairstyle to an older, person, you know, not older persons, but a 20-year-old hairstyle, 20-year-old at the time.
So she got rid of the Gidget ponytail, and June Cleaver bob.
She went and she did makeup, like more of an adult like, and all that, and she received the attention of the director
and got the part. That's good.
Well, and also had an affair with the director.
Oh my god! Wait! Hold on! You said, okay, she was actually 16 at the time.
Yes.
How old was the director?
Like 42.
Oh my god! Come on.
So hey. Wait. This, we're not done yet.
Oh no.
So through this as well, like, she was in a car accident, and when Nicholas Ray, the director, heard, he went to the hospital right away to see how she was doing and all that. And the police were being interviewed outside of the room where Natalie was being looked at. She was fine, by the way, but the cop, you know, motioned to her and said, you know, juvenile delinquent. Natalie Wood turned right to the director and said, did you hear what he said? Do I get the part?
Oh, my God. Wow. It sounds like everyone did some method acting in this. Method auditioning.
Method auditioning. So. So
16 and 40. What did you say? 40-something?
Yeah, like 42. Now,
that is.
She also had a relationship with Dennis Hopper during the filming.
Really?
Of this? Weird. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe she should have stopped wearing such, you know, so much red lipstick.
Yes. The director also apparently had a relationship with Salmoneo as well during the filming of this.
Oh.
Who was also 16.
Wow. Oh my god. This lends itself to a conversation that is referred to in literary terms as death of the artist. How do you separate an artist from their work? Nicholas Ray.
Like, Nicholas Ray. Like, but here's the thing. Name me another Nicholas Ray film.
Exactly. I was just thinking that.
and if anyone looks at this film, it's a James Dean film.
Yeah.
A lot of the, interviews done at the time, a lot of the actors, a lot of the crew and all that, they said that Nicholas Ray, because of the method acting that James Dean had, pretty much let James Dean direct the film. Like, he kind of sat back and just let Dean kind of set up what he wants, do what he needs to do to set it up.
That's fascinating. Well, I'd be happy to diverge into discussing James Dean and his overall performance in this.
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, so James Dean, yeah. So maybe start out with what is a method actor?
Method acting is this. You live and breathe the character. If the character is supposed to get hurt, you get hurt. If, for example, Christian Bale playing in The Machinist is supposed to be this emaciated, anorexic, gross skeletal human being, as a method actor, he starved himself to the point where the director said, stop, you weigh less than 100 pounds now. Someone like Daniel Day-Lewis, who asks that everyone refer to him as Mr. President when he's on set. Someone like Jared Leto, who is supposed to play a blind character in Blade Runner 2049, so he got blinding contacts. And this era here, the James Dean era, moving into the 60s, you get someone like Dustin Hoffman, and the very famous conversation with Laurence Olivier from Marathon Man, where Laurence Olivier came from classically trained Shakespeare company, British acting, and Dustin Hoffman being this new era of method acting, where if it says I'm supposed to be slapped, then you slap me. And if I'm supposed to be tired, I need to run around this place to be tired. And Laurence Olivier looking at him and saying, try acting, dear boy. It's easier. So method acting is, at the time, so experimental, because it wasn't you walk into a room and play to the audience and get from A to B. You can see stuff happening in this movie that seems commonplace now that at the time was actually the forerunner for what is commonplace. A great example of this is when Jim is having his argument with his parents by the stairs after the the car, the chicky race.
Yes.
And he goes home and James Dean is pacing the room and he's delivering dialogue with his back to camera, right? He's not playing to the camera. The camera has to play to him. And that is a type of, that's something that's going to occur in method acting, because the method says just live in the space, breathe in the space. If your body tells you to go here because that's where the character's going to go, then go there. I think that's a broad generalization of a lot of what method acting is.
Yeah, I think you said, and again, it was newer because so many of the actors before had come from the stage or came from vaudeville or came from that era of teaching that way. So you're playing to the audience, like you said. And you're turning your character on and off. I think you hear stories of actors who, yeah, you have to, even when the cameras aren't rolling, they go by, you have to stay in character and they can't change.
This is a type of acting that destroys people emotionally and mentally because they invest so much into their performance that it can affect their lives. Joaquin Phoenix is another person who does this.
Well, Heath Ledger,
yeah.
Heath Ledger died, of a drug overdose, but a lot of that was from what he did to himself to become the Joker.
Yeah, and it sucks because sometimes you see the ends, and does that justify the means to get such incredible performances out of people? I don't know. I have performed in roles as an actor that I've allowed pieces of myself to truly invest in, so that I'm truly raw and real, and that can be psychologically damaging.
Yeah, it can be traumatic. Not only for the actor, but the people working with the actor.
Yes, yes, of course. There's a great moment in Django when Leo slammed his hand on the table in the heat of the moment, cut his hand on the glass, and kept on going. Leo's not a method actor at the level of some of the other people we named, but that was heat of the moment stuff, and he kept rolling with it because he was so invested in the moment.
So there is a knife fight early in this film, and in one of the takes, James Dean got cut in the ear and was bleeding. Ugh. And the director yelled, "Cut!" And James Dean apparently got angry and livid at the director and just yelled at him, like, "Don't you ever cut a scene while I'm having a real moment."
Ugh, boy. It's hard to argue that the method is it. The method that some actors, the lengths that some actors go to, have given us some of the greatest performances in cinema. But at the same time, I don't know if I'd want to be involved in seeing that happen, because it's distressing to see someone deeply lose themselves in a performance. Thankfully, with something like this, Rebel Without a Cause is not. That Jim Stark as a character is not so damaged of a human being and so violent or dangerous that he's risking the very well-being of the cast and crew like you would get from other movies and other method actors. So there's small graces in that. But like when he punches the table at the beginning, when the chief is like, "You want to hit something?" I love that moment where he takes his jacket off, he puts his gun in the drawer, and he's like, "Okay, now that you're calm, you want to do something? Good, hit the desk. Get it out." And James Dean's just like punching the desk, and I can see he's punching that desk. He is not pulling. Yeah. The way he's rubbing his hand after that, that's real.
Yeah, he hurt his hand.
Of course he did, yeah.
He badly bruised his hand. He had to wear bandages for a week.
Oh, boy. A few times in performance, I've gone that extra mile to try to create the character. I shot something in a desert for 3 days, and I chose as a character that I would be barefoot. And my feet were rarely on screen, but here I was walking across the rocky, salty earth, cutting up the crap out of my feet because I thought my character needed to be barefoot all the time. I totally should have worn shoes.
At least like those Hobbit shoes, so it looked like you had shoes on or no shoes on. So James Dean, I feel, you know, and he is one of the first, you know, big method actor. I think Marlon Brando is another one that same era actually, you know, had tried out for this role as well.
Doesn't surprise me at all.
No. You know, I think there were a lot of directors that probably didn't know how to deal with this, but because of the success of East of Eden, so that was James Dean's first film, the fact that he got an Oscar nom for that, this film had started film. They started the filming already, and it was in black and white.
Interesting.
But because James Dean was becoming a huge name, the studio said, "Stop production. We're going color. Reshoot all that you've done already."
Oh my god.
Because they wanted to ride, and this is the only film where James Dean has top billing. Wow. Only film, because I mean he's only has three. So, you know.
I had heard rumors that they're going to resurrect James Dean to play a role in some movie in the next year. They're using
like CG the fake
deep faking, and like it's not the same thing because it's not about what the character looks like. It's not it's the heart and soul of these performances.
Yeah.
So they shot it and they started filming black and white, and then the success of East Eden, Warner Brothers was like, "Okay, we will invest in color film." Because this is still the era of black and white and color films. Color films were very
expensive. Yep, the big ones. It was very expensive. Not to be used. And this was, you know, this was an era where there were a lot of similar type films. I think in the 1950s, you had an era of like teen angst, especially I mean, a lot of it was, you know, more the lower class teens, I mean, typically white, but this is clearly middle class, white, suburban type kids.
Yeah, it's funny that the title is Rebel Without a Cause. I was thinking about that as I was watching it, and it's James Dean, Jim Stark as a character, is this rebel against the world, and he has no reason to be. His parents love him. He's got a safe home. He's got a car. He's taken care of. He has no just cause to be so rebellious, I suppose, is my analysis of the title.
I mean, it sounds like he's had issues kind of fitting in, making friends and all that, because his parents have moved a lot.
Hey, nobody calls me chicken. Nobody.
Yeah. So I had heard that that was a revenant in Back to the Future Part 2. That's a big plot point that comes from this.
I had no idea.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, like, did you know that?
I didn't know that. So when it happened, I was like, no way. And there's a couple occasions. The reason they had to move towns was because some kid called him chicken and he got in a fight, pretty severe fight. I love that his mom was like, that's it, we're moving again.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, so we'll get into that. Instead, just, you know, let's finish up on James Dean, because I think that part of the film is very interesting. But, yeah, you know, and I think today, like, I don't know how many people who love James Dean have actually seen a James Dean film. Because it's like you said, I think that now his look is iconic.
Right.
That the look in this film with the red jacket, the T-shirt, the sunglasses, the hair, that is all iconic now. And that is what people gravitate towards. I don't think if they saw the film, I have more respect for James Dean now. I mean, I knew that he was Hollywood cool, but just seeing this film and learning more about him and, you know, kind of what he was pushing in this film too, especially with the homosexuality in the era that it was.
What a loss. Wow. You're right. I've similarly always felt like, yeah, he's James Dean. I know. I get it. He's cool. But this does give me a new appreciation of who he was and what could have been. Oof.
Yeah. So there were a couple critical scenes that I want to talk about a little bit more.
Okay.
One is that scene with him confronting his parents. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned before about how, you know, this was a change of time. For how cinema was kind of used. Mm-hmm. And there were two Dutch angles.
Yes.
In that scene. And that immediately, when I was watching it, made me think, like, oh, this director is using the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so many directors just set up a camera on a tripod, or maybe they do some movement, they'll track an actor. But to use something like a Dutch angle where the camera goes on a 45-degree angle almost.
Mm-hmm.
So the scene goes a little sideways.
Askew.
It evokes emotion in just that little turn of how things are going, of how the scene is not going well.
Yeah, there's another great actor. One where he's lying on the couch and he's laying upside down and his mom comes in the room and the camera is upside, the shot is upside down and does a full 180 to come upright. So there was some minor camera movements happening here that were ahead of their time as well. But that Dutch angle in their fight, you were saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that just, you know, because again, having seen a lot of films from this era and before, the camera was definitely more of just a window.
Mm-hmm.
And we're watching it. When the character starts becoming a character in the film, starts providing some emotion and some you know, is telling the story. Yeah, I saw that scene, and you know, the cuts too became a little bit more frantic as Jim is asking his dad to stand up to his mom.
Yeah. Stand up for me. And he grabs poor Thurston Howell and chucks him over the couch. Like, that is one of the best scenes in the movie. because I think those three actors are working at the top of their game. I think that the mother and father, those two are playing really well against probably how they were classically trained to go up against this new young guy. There's a lot of layers to that scene in particular, of the fighting on the stairs, the fact that she's towering above him, she's up a level, and his dad's the most submissive because he's down a level, so blocking is doing stuff, the camera movement's doing stuff, James Dean is doing stuff. Like, there's a lot in that onion.
There is, and it's there was apparently a big Hollywood, so Thurston Howell, Jim Backus is the actor. So in Gilligan's Island, he was Thurston Howell. There is a scene where he's directing a film of Ruth the Castaways. And at one point, he yells out, as his character Thurston Howell yells out, "Method actors, never again!" Because he struggled.
Method actors, never again!
He struggled badly with trying to act opposite of a method actor.
Yeah, because it's that the rigid training of classical theater actors and that transition into film is when you dive into and explore the history of cinema, it's such a fascinating study on how stories are told to an audience, to go from a live audience to the camera, moving, like, not just being a window. Now let's let the camera do stuff that we didn't do before. Yeah. So it doesn't surprise me that he struggled with it, but whatever conflict he might've had with it came through in how disconnected he was as a father to his son, but wanting to connect. You can talk to me, son. I'm here. I will listen. Like, it's a very powerful scene. And as we kick this off, this whole review, as we've been discussing, that there were some key scenes, that being one of them, where I thought this is as good as anything you would get now.
It is interesting how they wrote Dad Stark's character.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, again, this is an era where it's men have to act and men have to be a certain way.
Yeah, there's the other scene in the bedroom with the knife wounds where he's wearing an apron, a flowery...
Over his suit. And he's wearing an apron, and he's, you know, he is scared of his wife, essentially. He
Jim's
drops...
like, leave it.
Yeah.
Yeah, drop that set. Leave it. Let her see it.
Yeah. And so the expectations of the son are, you're supposed to act like this, Dad. You're supposed to be a man. You're supposed to be in charge. You're supposed to stand up for me, and he's not doing it because he is, you know, subservient in that respect to the wife. And, you know, so there's that kind of social confusion going on where society is saying you need to be this way, and he doesn't see it. Jim doesn't see it. And so that kind of causes him to kind of act the way he does, where he doesn't make friends, he drinks, he's embarrassed by his home life, so he tries to hide it and overcompensates himself. So I thought that whole sense, those two scenes where Jim tries to talk to his dad to say, should I do this? You know, why should I do this? And you know,
it's honor, Dad. Like, you foolish kid.
Yeah.
Just walk away. You don't have to.
Yep. And then the scene at the stairs with all three.
Yeah. Did you have any other scenes that stood out to you? Because there's, I'd like to mention one.
The other one was the chicken fight itself.
Oh, the one that was driving.
Yeah, the drive. The one that was based on Paul Abdul's video for Rush Rush.
You'd sent me that before I'd watched the movie. I'm like, I'll keep an eye out for this. Whatever you're talking about, I'll keep an eye out for it. Oh man, I felt bad for, what's his name? Buzz was the antagonistic.
Yeah.
His jacket gets caught on the handle. What a dickhead.
Well, you know, and even he said he's basically the part that I liked is when Jim and Buzz are standing on the cliff looking over it.
Yeah.
And Buzz says to him, "Hey, I like you. I like you, but you know, we have to do this.
We gotta do this, man.
Again, it's fitting those societal norms.
Nah.
And again, that's the rebel, right? Yeah. That's why he's a rebel, because he's like, doesn't, you know, doesn't quite fit in with those. But yeah, I mean, that those little things, like, what I liked is that showed, until that moment, Buzz was a very one-dimensional character. Mm-hmm. He was the bad guy. He was the bully. He was kind of pushing. Yeah. You know, here's the new kid. Let's beat him up. Here's the kid that's a loner. Let's beat him up. Let's antagonize them. Mm-hmm. But that moment where he's like, hey, man, I like you. Here's a cigarette.
Yeah.
You know, like, it showed depth to that character. And then of course, he doesn't make it.
He just drives right off a cliff. When they go to the mansion, first off, let me just say, there's no way there'd be an abandoned mansion within sight of the Griffith Observatory in 2021. But that sequence where they're in there and Judy and Jim are pretending to be the couple while they get the tour.
Plato's being the kid.
Yeah. It's cute. And Pluto goes off on his own and Jim and Judy lay down together, and she sort of confesses. She's like, I never knew. What do you think love is? What should love be? What should a husband mm-hmm. be? I think I never knew what love is until right now. And it's so innocent and so naive. But it's just very, that whole sequence in that whole set of scenes in the mansion, laying by the candlelight and just talking there. That feels like the epitome of an entire genre of indie filmmaking. And while I would say this movie is essential viewing, which is why it's being discussed right now in this podcast.
Yeah.
I think this is essential viewing for those aspiring indie filmmakers who are trying to have a voice or a way to the way to say certain things. Because that scene reminded me of Garden State, the Zach Braff mm-hmm. movie. That scene reminded me of The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. There's a level of anything the Duplass brothers have done, which is all mumblecore, make up the lines as you go along. Here's the scene. There's a type of indie, low-budget filmmaking that has those sincere, lost youth conversations about life and love and death that is epitomized in 1955 in such a simple way.
Well, and again, I mean, I think you said, like, it goes back to what we said before. Like, it's capturing how so well, you know, I think the writing is so strong in this film because it still captures so well how Judy is trapped in two worlds. Mm-hmm. She's still a little girl. But she's also a woman, and you know, and she needs to, you know, this is where she needs to go. It makes sense to me, you know, in her mind, based on the way she's acting, like, yeah, Buzz just died. She's not reacting to it the way we would, but she's
numb by her own admission. She's a numb,
she's a confused, numb 16-year-old who probably was with Buzz just because it was Buzz, but didn't have any, you know, wasn't. There's nothing there. There's nothing deep or anything.
In general, I feel like this movie's not going to appeal. I review a lot of movies. I study a lot of film because I want to craft better films myself. And oftentimes I will watch movies where I can see plain and simply every step of the way that a modern movie watcher would hate this. It's dumb. It's slow. It's old. It doesn't have any explosions or excitement. Like, all that's undeveloped taste in film. Yeah, fine. You aren't even listening to this podcast, so who am I even talking to right now? But I think the aspiring filmmaker, the one who hasn't looked at the standards and the essentials of the classic films, should look at something like this, to watch Rebel Without a Cause, to be able to go, oh my God, Richard Linklater. Oh my God, Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Oh my God, Tarantino even. Kevin Smith, like James Franco, to move into more modern stuff. James Franco started his career by winning an Emmy by playing James Dean. I think there's a lot to be learned from a movie like this.
Yeah. I mean, again, I mean, what director? We've mentioned Steven Spielberg. Those other directors that you mentioned, like all the big ones, like they're pulling stuff from this film.
Mm-hmm.
Something essential from this film.
Something spoke to them. And it makes sense because you can see stuff in this that has echoed all the way to today. And that's really cool. I have watched more than a handful of films courtesy of you for the Filmological Society, the 100 Comedies. And I see these movies that are considered these definitive comedic pieces of cinema, mm-hmm. and they are forgettable or they are uninspired through my tastes.
Yeah.
At the same time, then I can see stuff like Ghostbusters or The Apartment, and I go, oh, I see that this is still good today because of A, B, and C. And so, yeah, there are probably countless films from this era that are more or less crap because they weren't hitting the pulse correctly, or they weren't willing to take a chance on a rebel, no pun intended, like a rebellious performance like James Dean and what he crafted here.
Yeah, I don't know, like, the top grossing films of this year,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I think when any time you have a film that is pushing what's considered acceptable, mm-hmm. it's going to have it's going to live longer, you know, as long as it's pushing, I think, the more progressive what's acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Because you look at some other films, you know, some of the silent films, like Birth of a Nation or something like that, where it's considered, oh, this film is you know, this is the first film to do this or that or whatever. But the themes and the story within a film like Birth of a Nation do not work today at all. And that is not a film that should be watched because of that.
Mm-hmm. That they
even work. Though it does so much, apparently, for cinema. Where this film is pushing different types of limits, you know, pushing things to the edge, and it makes it where it's, to me, it didn't feel like a film from 1955.
Yeah, most of the time, yes. Yeah, 100%. That there were those occasional moments that felt dated, but you said it earlier that this film was capturing a voice of the era. And looking at the top 10 of the year, there are a couple other films of this era that are still to this day good because they did a similar thing about teenage. It's the beatnik generation before the flower child generation. This is a mm-hmm. pre-Vietnam era. Guys and Dolls and The 7-Year Itch and Lady and the Tramp.
Oklahoma?
Oklahoma's in there too. But particularly Lady and the Tramp and Guys and Dolls are similarly themed, outsiders in society, couples who meet who find themselves through each other. Lady and the Tramp, I know, is just a silly dog movie, but thematically, there's a lot of similarities between Lady and the Tramp and Rebel Without a Cause, weirdly.
Well, and, you know, when you read that, so, I mean, because you talk about Oklahoma and Guys and Dolls and people... Most people I can't imagine would think of the film first versus the stage play.
Right.
Like, yeah. Everyone's going to go for the musical. Everyone knows Oklahoma and everyone knows Guys and Dolls or a song from there or whatever.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
Right. But, you know, Lady and the Tramp being a cartoon, it's always going to have that timeless factor with it where it's right. not, it doesn't look as dated. But a lot of those other films that you said there, like, most people aren't going to know what they are. They're not going to, you know, 7-Year Itch, maybe the one that stands out as well as this film.
Because of Marilyn.
I think. And that's because of Marilyn, another Hollywood icon who left us early.
Yeah. But this is good. I'm glad that you suggested this. I know we're having a conversation about movies to watch, and I had thrown this out there as an option. So I'm glad that you liked it, and I'm curious to watch more of these. We're not going to go through the AFI. We're not going to go through the the IMDb top 250 or anything like that. This will just be one of those occasions of, like, movies that are so ingrained into pop culture that you can have conversations about them in cinephile groups without ever having seen them, right? Like,
yeah.
For ages, I could have a full conversation about Rocky, and I'd never actually seen the movie.
I think there's so many of those movies. And one of the things doing the list show with Chad, which you join us every once in a while, or the other one, like when you see some of these films, and you know, like especially that comedy list, you see a joke, and you know, have seen that joke now 50 times in different movies. And it's like, okay, this is where the joke was first done. And while it's not as funny now, back then it would have been one of the best jokes ever. And it was so good that they've done it 50 more times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at this and yeah, Fry dresses like James Dean in Futurama.
Yeah.
And, you know, so many wannabe auteurs taking lines, and I'm talking to you, Tommy Wiseau, taking lines from this and thinking that it's elevating their work, when really it's not. It just says you
watch
this
film. There's homage and there's parody.
Yeah. And there's attempted homage that becomes parody. But yeah, for... a movie that was named after a book that the studio bought but didn't refer to the book at all because it was like a psychological book. I would recommend this film.
I would too.
I would. There's nobody. I mean, unless you are just hate anything that, you know, if your favorite films, you know,
Fast and the Furious,
Transformers, like Michael Bay, I'm first in line. Okay, maybe you don't see this.
Yeah. But I think, you know, from a directing, from a writing, from an acting perspective, that, and just from a film studies, classics piece of cinema study, there's worth in watching this. This is an actor's movie, and I would recommend this to performers who are looking to study classic cinema and classic acting methods that still exist today. This would certainly be one to go. If only to go, I would never do that.
Well, yeah. I think it's a good time to wrap up on that note.
Yeah.
That we would both do this. So thank you for joining.
Yeah, this is great. I look forward to discussing some. We made a little mini list of some of those movies worth watching, and I'm looking forward to elevating and educating ourselves by checking these out.
Yeah, and you know, whether it be an iconic actor or iconic director that, you know, is most likely not with us anymore. Yeah, I'm hoping, and our next film will be a classic film, The Seven Samurai.
Seven Samurai. I've never seen it.
Yeah, neither have I.
I'm looking to...
It was going to be our first one, and then we both discovered it is a 3.5-hour film.
Something tells me it's going to be a better crafted 3.5-hour film than, we'll just say, a more recent 4-hour film. But, you know, what do I know? We'll see.
We'll do a scene breakdown yes. between the two films.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris. If people want to find me, they can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I don't use Twitter too often, but Twitter and Instagram at TC's Big Head. If you want to hear me talk about screenwriting and the process of screenwriting, I have a screenwriting podcast called The Studio Demands It. So you can find it on Apple, what are they calling it now? iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever, whatever have you. And listen to the process of writing screenplays.
Is season 3 coming soon?
Season 3, we are currently recording it right now. We're a few episodes in, and we've already had some fun. I'm happy to promote it and tell people to listen to it.
Yes, everyone listen to it and figure out when they actually have fun in season 3. Cuz as TC said, they just started having fun. All right. You can find me at Badger Colfax on Twitter, probably my most active place. mostly stalking, but, you know, I do occasionally share things, too, so. So, thank you. I don't have an ending, because this is Essentials, so,
essentially, yeah. This is the end, is what we're doing right here.
I think so. All right. Thank you, everybody.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghost Hat Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthat.net.